Thanks, Steve, and thanks, Ted. By my watch, we have 15 minutes or so for questions and contributions. The speakers are coming up, if they can find some space here. And I'll stay at the mic and see if I can chair this particular part. Brother there.
All right. So something that, for me, is crucial to climate change mitigation, which we all agree should happen quickly. So I think most people here would agree that governments should do something to lower emissions drastically and should do it quickly. Now, last time I looked at the poll, 28% of people in the U.S., only 28% thought that doing something about climate change should be a priority for the government. And like we know, you know, what the mindset is generally. We know how people scream when gas prices increase and so on. And so my question is, in this context, is there hope for public opinion around here to change quickly enough for the governments to be able to react quickly enough? Or can the governments do something quickly enough without public opinion changing significantly? And also, in terms of doing something radical, as I see as an alternative to what Mr. Sweeney was talking about, to direct control, perhaps a strong and important tax on emissions could be, I also consider a strong and perhaps effective government intervention. Thanks.
Thank you, Will. Can we take a couple more rather than just respond? I think that question was aimed probably towards me, and I'd rather hear from others for now, but I appreciate the question. Any? Sir?
I'm just going to broaden the question that was just asked. Where is sufficient support going to come from to convince enough governments and enough business to engage in social enterprises? Because we're talking about major transformation here, or the necessity of major transformation, not just individual successes. So where do we get sufficient support from business, from universities, from the public, in order to mobilize? In other words, we all know what should be done. The question is, how is it going to happen?
Okay, I think that was aimed more to Steve, I think. Was it? Do you want to take it now, Steve, or should we see if there's a couple more questions, maybe?
Well, why don't we start there? I wouldn't mind trying to answer both of those at the same time.
Okay.
Is that okay? So I think the boreal forest case taught us that it was actually NGOs in the community sector working with business, their sworn enemies, supposedly. It was them coming together that really created the momentum around this. Government wasn't at the table. Government was afraid to step forward because business is such a powerful lobby with government. We had to see a different kind of dynamic between community sector and the resource companies. Government then came on board, is on board now, but it has to happen in that order, I think, at this, when we're talking about things at this scale. Unless, because it looks like government is too stuck. It really can't move unless we have a revolution or you know, some kind of, we thought Obama was going to do this in the States. God knows who could do it here at the federal level. So we actually have to work, I think, both from the bottom up, but also from a multi-sectoral perspective to try and create the winning conditions for movement on this. And in terms of when is business going to get involved, a lot of big business does. The big insurance companies have been hit hard enough now already that they know things have to change. And risk management is no longer a case of, do we put our money in Japan and in Germany and in South America? It's about, no, do we put it in the present or do we put it in a future that is sustainable? Let's start investing in the new models. And business is beginning to appreciate that. The head of Macquarie Capital, which is an extremely sharp global financial company, was on the Social Finance Task Force and is continuing to appear now in the Globe and Mail and elsewhere. Sir Ronald Stern in the UK, similarly a multi-billionaire. Business people are starting to get this, and I think that's going to help to move the whole issue.
Great. Any other questions? I'd like to also respond at some point, but sister there.
I was just going to ask a question about the Evergreen Initiative. I was just wondering, what was the criteria for getting the community members? Was it just you put an advert out and whoever's got the skills, or do you look for people who have a vision for entrepreneurship? Like, what's the... How do we know who gets lucky? You know what I mean?
Right, right. And, you know, there's such a crying need for jobs in our community that when the Evergreen Cooperative Laundry opened, in October 2009, and we opened with just 8 workers because we didn't have enough business to be more than that. Within 30 days, with no advertising on our part, we had received 500 applications for jobs. So there's, you know, an enormous desire. The way we do it is we're working with a nonprofit organization in Cleveland that works with people who have what are euphemistically called barriers to employment. That often means they have criminal records, and so it's very difficult for them to get hired. And this group Towards Employment helps prepare people to move back into the job market. And what we do is we simply work with them and say, we have 5 jobs coming up. One's a truck driver, one's folding sheets, one's, you know, a mechanic. And we want you to bring 3 people for each job. And then we screen them, and we talk to them, we interview them. We don't discriminate if someone has a felony record. We ask that they divulge that and tell us the circumstances. 50% of the people we've hired to date have felony criminal records. And we talk about the vision of cooperative ownership, because it's not for everybody. A lot of people just don't want to be bothered. They're happy to have a job, but they don't want all the trust me, it's, you know, this it kind of looks great, but it's as difficult as anything else. So there's a kind of screening process, and that's how we do it. But the issue, I talked about building 500 jobs. But our challenge is, in this community of 43,000 people, how do we create 5,000 jobs? Because it's going to need to be something like that to tip the balance in the community economically. And we don't have the answer for that, but that's the vision inside of which we're working.
Great. Any thanks for that, Ted. Any other comments, brother?
I just want to add some comments as a reflection as a young person and seeing sort of the society that we're moving towards. From what I've heard in terms of the Boreal Agreement, for example, it actually left a certain portion of the Boreal Forest at least 10 times the amount being saved to potential logging. I've also heard that NGOs within the process were being muzzled and silenced from then speaking out later on about the corporations that they were involved with, and also certain requirements that if, let's say, another NGO approached them about a partnership for a certain action, that they were supposed to report that, and getting into the slap kind of lawsuits that often devastate NGOs. And to me, it kind of feels like you're trying to salvage an old paradigm that, in light of the financial crisis in 2008, is really antiquated. And it's like staring at the Berlin Wall and trying to salvage communism by building it up one brick at a time. And I think there's a fundamental shift that's needed that extends beyond sort of the social enterprise, which kind of just feels like rebranding capitalism.
Okay.
And I don't have the answers necessarily as to what, but that's my reaction to it.
Great. I think we have time for a couple more. I'd like to respond in a moment to the public opinion issue if I can, but.
My name is Håkan Tropp, working with the Stockholm Water Institute. I think throughout the whole day here, I mean, we've heard a lot about sort of the role of government. We have to affect government. I don't think we can rely too much on governments. I think in a way that citizens and consumers have to take their own destiny in their own hands, basically. And I would like to have some ideas from you, how you would see, I mean, how we can act as more conscious citizens or more conscious consumers, for example. I mean, how can we more consciously sort of punish what we may think as bad government behavior or bad behavior from private companies, for example? And that these, some years back when for example, France, they were having nuclear tests in some small islands, I think it was Bikini Islands, there were these spontaneous boycotts of French products, for example. People in Sweden and other countries in Europe, they stopped buying French cheeses, French wines. After a month, this was gone, of course, and people started to drink wine from France again. It's quite good, so we couldn't resist it. But point being that, I mean, there's a lot of things we can do as consumers and citizens.
Okay. Can we take one more, and then maybe you have some wrap-up comments from the speakers? I see none, So is this rare? So would you like to? Oh, okay. I'll take the first shot. Shut me up if I go on too long, please. I'm supposed to be moderating, so it's hard to keep control of my own comments. On the public opinion question, I think it's true that after the sort of the Al Gore and their focus on the climate change and convenient truth, that U.S. public opinion was quite high, around the realm, if I remember, of 70% saying it wanted government action on climate protection. Then the recession comes, and you start to see high levels of unemployment. The political right begins to push back, saying it's going to cost jobs, there's going to be an energy tax, and you saw public opinion soften. But it's still not low, despite all the attacks on the climate issue and the issues around the science. It's not low. But I don't feel on its own it's enough. I think when you've got levels of unemployment in the United States, that the real unemployment level is around about 18%. And for communities of color, it's in the 20s%. And as we saw in some of the excellent geographics of this, demographics and geographics are such that it's highly concentrated in certain communities. If there was an energy conservation program that could provide work, save on electricity bills, and reduce emissions, I think that would be a popular program. I don't think it's an easy thing to do. The challenges are definitely there, but I think there can be public opinion would be brought around anything that creates reasonably paid work at this present time. On the carbon tax and income tax issue, the carbon tax debate, I think, if it's an added tax on middle class and working class people, you're going to get pushback. There's going to be no doubt about it. Somehow we have to do the energy conservation work and the infrastructure long-term work without using the price mechanism overly much. I'll just give you an anecdote when I was a kid, and I'll hand it on to another speaker. When I grew up in a working-class council house estate in England, in Bristol, and we were told by the local authority that we had to leave the house for 3 days to another house, identical, and it was fun. We were kids. We went there. It was a new house. It was fun. We came back 3 days later. The whole building had been double glazed, the ceiling had been renewed, and the insulation throughout the whole house, the electricity bills plummeted. There was nothing on the point of the consumer really didn't have to do anything. It was a self-financing program that the government put in place. And the government gets a lot of bad, publicity these days. But if we do look back even in U.S. history, the role of government in providing cheap electrical power, we don't need cheap electrical power now, but we provided it, we provided many things as part of the New Deal architecture, that kind of thinking, at least that level of ambition, needs to be returned to today, I would suggest. So I'll move over to Ted. Do you want to take the next one?
These are kind of by way of concluding remarks,
yes,
too, right?
Yes.
So one thing I've been struck by at this conference yesterday and today is the idea, while maybe not stated in this way, I think a lot of us are grappling with the idea of, given the challenges we're facing, climate change being one of the extraordinary ones, but not the only, how do we make history in this time in our lives? How do we actually advance things to get beyond, in a serious way, where we are right now? And, there are a couple models historically, because we know systems come and go. The Egyptians had a system, and it's gone. And the Greeks had a system, and the feudal ages. So we know that systems do change. They're not ordained by God, so people do build them, and people take them apart. And there are a couple models, and one, obviously, is revolution. And one asks oneself, in Canada or in the United States, does one see a real revolution in the way we mean that historically? For myself, I don't see that. There is stagnation of a system. Rome eventually did just wind down and disappear. That does happen. Then there's another way that I would call a kind of evolutionary reconstruction of a system, which is to start to build and put in place the new institutions and building blocks and new vision for what's needed. And we all have our theory of change, and mine is there are really three elements needed in terms of mobilizing people to move forward. One is a serious critique of what's taking place, and we've heard that a lot here. But that's not enough, because we know that simply the critique of what's not working doesn't get people up and moving. A second piece of it, I believe, is building things like Evergreen and like so many of the good things we heard here. I don't believe that Evergreen's going to transform American capitalism. What I do believe is if you can show people a model, look, people got together and they're organizing work in a new way. They're enjoying their work. They're actually building their wealth. It's working. You can start to see glimmers of a new system, that it doesn't all need to be organized the way it is now. We can get beyond that. And then third, we actually need to do the difficult intellectual work to envision the new system that we want to build. As a colleague of mine, a political economist, Gar Alperovitz, says, if you don't like capitalism and you don't like socialism, well, what do you want? And that's a very profound question. What do we want? If we think this system isn't making it, if we think communism or the competing system historically wasn't all that great, what kind of system do we want to build that is going to produce different outcomes than the one that we're producing right now? And that is, I say, none of us know that yet, but that's the work ahead of us, is thinking through the new system. And God pray, given the inexorable drive of climate change, that we have enough time to build that system. But that's what this conference, for me, is actually all about.
I was at a conference in Phoenix, Arizona recently of the Resilience Alliance, which looks at how systems are changing and what our likely futures are going to be from a variety of perspectives. And my talk was interrupted by someone in the audience who said that actually because the U.S. dollar was about to collapse for a variety of reasons, the real thing was to start thinking about creating community currencies to pay for the local militia that we would need to defend ourselves when the U.S. federal government went bankrupt and couldn't pay the army to do what it does. So in a sense, just building on what Ted was saying, we do face some uncertain and challenging futures. We do actually have to think this through, and at this stage, we need prototyping, we need new ideas, creativity, innovation, and commitment, and reflection in order to look at what's possible, to start to privilege those things that do, in fact, represent a sustainable and attractive future for ourselves. We're here today to talk about social entrepreneurship, which in fact implies both a social commitment, a commitment on all of our parts to be responsible consumers, to be responsible researchers, et cetera, but also to reshape the terms of engagement around what we call capitalism or what is our economic system. Because obviously, it is a big part of the problem, and we are all part of it. So we each have a very personal stake in this, and a very particular, depending on where we are, who our neighbors are, what kind of work we're doing, an important commitment to make to working this through for this and future generations. Thank you.
I think we're done for this session. I'd like again thanks to our speakers. And thanks for your patience and participation. I think we're going to go straight into the next panel.